Does everyone get treated the same in our society? Are advantages and opportunities the same for everyone? What if an entire generation is squeezed so hard that its members lose hope or live lives so restricted that their ability to function is significantly impaired? Think of the experiences of youth and the elderly. Do we value their place in our communities fairly, or do they get the short end of the stick? Today's guest is immersed in exploring the notion of fairness for all citizens in Canada. Paul Kershaw is a tenured professor at UBC's School of Population and Public Health and the award-winning founder of Generation Squeeze, a nonprofit organization whose important and practical goal is achieving, quote, generational fairness to preserve what Canadians hold sacred, a healthy childhood, home, retirement, and planet, so we all leave a proud legacy. We're delighted to have the high-minded and very down-to-earth Paul Kershaw with us today. Paul, welcome.
Well, thanks for such a generous introduction. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, my introduction was a small fraction of material that I could have included, and we'll get to some of that as we go along. Your website, as I have mentioned to you and others, is a tsunami of information, but the kind that you want to go swimming in as opposed to the kind you want to run away from. Now, I want to ask you a very important question that will set the tone for the entire interview. And it is this. Did you shovel any manure this morning?
I shovel manure every morning. My days start by shoveling manure and they end by shoveling manure. So now you're outing me to your listeners that I live on a little farm, and in the morning and the night, I really am very focused on farming. During the day, I'm a professor and I run Generation Squeeze as part of that work and as a volunteer, but I try not to. I lift a lot of manure in the morning, a lot of manure at night, so I try not to spread too much BS during the day.
Well done. That sounds like a quote from yourself as well. And it's a 5-acre farm in Pitt Meadows, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. It's because it's a real thing, and it's part of your life, and it inevitably shapes some of your views in the world, whether it's immediately obvious or not. Let's get into something a little more relevant to Generation Squeeze, and that is, how did it come into existence? How did you get the name, for example? Generation Squeeze is fairly evocative.
Well, I'll answer that part first. There was a real debate back around 2010 when we were coming up with a communications plan to frame the research, and should we be Generation Squeezed or should we be Generation Screwed? And if you're screwed, there's no hope. And so we set that aside and said, if you're squeezed, you can take a lemon and squeeze back and make lemon juice. So we're going to turn lemons into lemonade, and that can be hopeful. So we were very intentional about organizing our work around that opportunity. That there's a problem now, but we can adapt and we can restore something even better. And why did we need to focus on the challenges facing, at the time, what I call the generations raising young children? I worked at a research institute at UBC called the Human Early Learning Partnership. And we were doing some groundbreaking work that showed an astonishingly high proportion of children, over 30%, were starting in our school system in BC and really across the country in ways that meant they were vulnerable. Vulnerable to failing in, hungry. They were hungry, maybe not appropriately dressed because their parents were struggling with costs. They were struggling sometimes socially and emotionally with different kinds of anxiety. And they were struggling less often, interestingly, with their 1-2-3s and ABCs. Mm. And so we said, why do we have a high level of vulnerability? Biologically, there should be no reason for more than 10% of kids to be vulnerable. We were picking up 3 times that. And that started me, I'm not a child development scholar so much as a public policy scholar. I'm like, let's look at how we're investing.
For sure.
And I was surprised to learn, now over 20 years ago, the Canadians are actually remarkably generous at investing later in the life course, which matters. My mom's 81. She lives in Salmon Arm.
She does indeed.
Who doesn't want their mother to have anything but a healthy and dignified retirement? And mm-hmm. my grandmother lived 103 in the Okanagan. And at the time, in her final years, she was using probably more taxpayer dollars than any citizen in Canada. She lived in a long-term care facility that was geared to her income. The cost of it was geared to her income. Her income was primarily the Canada Pension Plan and Old Age Security. So those are taxpayer-supported programs. And she was using a lot of medical care that we are publicly subsidizing. Mm-hmm. And I treasured it. But neither my mother nor my grandmother would have ever said they wanted those things to come at the expense of crowding out investments in what makes their children and grandchildren well. And unfortunately, whether we're talking about housing, childcare, education, or investing in a stable planet, we are doing that with less urgency, and it is putting at real risk the health and well-being of our children. That is what Gen Squeeze was born from.
So let me stop you there and ask if there's a reflection in the people who are working in Generation Squeeze, because I looked through the list of, you know, people who participate actively. Four of the six are women, and you even have a former family physician working in the organization. Yeah. I wonder if you're seeing, you and I are both males, but I wonder if you're seeing an increased involvement of women playing a meaningful role in bringing up issues that sometimes in a more competitive male-dominated environment are not always talked about. But these are issues that are so central. Raising children to be in a secure place is very central to the life of many women, but it's also something that involves nurturing rather than, you know, competing. And I'm wondering if that's sort of a feature, because it's certainly a feature of Generation Squeeze, is all around caring. It's all around nurturing.
Well, it's interesting first off, you're right. We have a number of really talented women leaders in our organization that I'm so proud to call my colleagues and learn from every day. So a full shout out to all of them. In addition to that, you're actually inviting a second origin story for Generation Squeeze.
We love origin stories.
Well, a second part of the origin story for Generation Squeeze is that, I mean, you're talking to someone whose first book started out by saying, you know, this is a book about feminism and asking actually men to recognize more and more our responsibilities for caregiving as citizens and as family members in order to disrupt the gender division of caregiving, the gender division of earnings, the occupational segregation. Right. And so Gen Squeeze, in many respects, another element of it's less, I don't know, everybody's so anti-woke these days, so it'll be less popular to hear. Not on this show. But Gen Squeeze is definitely, driven by a commitment to feminism, but recognize that some of the feminist framings for public policy change weren't winning the day in Canada. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, Gen Squeeze was really involved in winning billions and billions of dollars in investments for $10 a day childcare. We didn't come up with the importance of a national childcare policy. That happened in the 1970 Royal Commission on the Status of Women. But decades later, we still hadn't won the day. And one thing Gen Squeeze takes pride in being good at is trying to frame information and evidence for the cultural context of that moment when, in ways that mean it's most likely to win change. And so we were trying to create a complementary set of analyses and communication tools that would say we should invest in childcare for gender equality. Yeah. We should invest in childcare to get better child development. But you know what? Those aren't winning. So you know why politicians should care? Because increasingly families are getting so squeezed by childcare being another rent or mortgage-sized payment. And if only we could bring it down to $10 a day, they would be more enthusiastic to vote for you.
Yes.
And indeed, that did become a winning argument far too late, long after the recommendation came out. But when the federal government in 2021 put $30 billion into childcare, they called it $10 a day, and they said they didn't want childcare to be another rent or mortgage-sized payment.
Now you, which is lovely to see your own language appearing in government policy, but you've also raised, I think indirectly, a third origin story, and that is the difference between studying and researching things and telling people who are either in a decision-making position or at least out in the general public what you've found out and why it's important. It seems to me that... Yeah. That this is a key role that's been built, as they say, baked in, as they say these days, to the work of Generation Squeeze. It's all about saying, this is what's happening, not I did some research and I published it in an obscure journal, but this is what's happening in your community, around you, with the people that you live in community with. That seems to be a key part.
Yeah. What another great observation. I feel like now I'm on a counselor's chair and we're kind of going through therapy and you're asking me to reflect on like, how did I get to where I am today, which is a gift. So I'm now kind of sprawling.
I can't help myself after 50 years of insight oriented psychotherapy.
Yeah. I'm sprawling on the sofa and I'm digging into the therapy. So two things. When I started out as a young academic, I was inspired by this fellow named Clyde Hertzman, who ran the Human Early Learning Partnership.
Know him, yes.
Clyde Hertzman could have got a job at any university on the planet, including, I remember when I was first getting my job, my office was lucky. I was right next door to him, and I walked into his office one day, and there was a letter recruiting him to a prestigious position in Harvard. And he said no. He was really excited about the work he was doing in BC and Canada because he'd created this opportunity not only to be world-renowned in talking about the information, but he had a real clear vision about how to try and change the country. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, oh, that's what academics do. Okay, wonderful. We don't just publish in the peer-reviewed literature. It turns out that Clyde was a lucky inspiration for me because the academy still is a little bit slow to know that we need to not only just publish in peer-reviewed journals that 7 people read, including my grandmother when she was alive, but to know that we're in, more and more than ever, we're in a competition with fake news. There is such an explosion of information out in the world today and an ability to distribute it so quickly, so broadly, indeed, that the spread of misinformation is so pervasive. And the only antidote to that is those of us who have careers, you know, that get to devote to like what is the actual evidence, need not only to produce the evidence, but to work much more tirelessly ensuring that the evidence gets to compete with the fake news.
Yes.
And
I was going ahead. To say that really happens on your website. I've actually incorporated a little graphic in my notes here that it looks like Stonehenge in its current state, with a few bricks lying on its side and columns and stuff. But it is very eloquent. And all through writing graphics, and I mentioned before the show, I mentioned that you were aspiring to be Rick Mercer because you have a beautiful walking talk, the way Rick, with all his, you know, this hour has 23 minutes, where you rambled down past graffiti on the wall, and they turned the camera at an angle, which is another Mercerism. But it's very eloquent. People, you know, you get drawn into that kind of presentation. It's not something that you walk past and say, oh, that's, you know, I've seen that a million times before. It isn't the case. So actually, the tools of communication play a big role in what you've assembled in terms of Operation Squeeze and the other thing, Generation Squeeze and the other things being involved in. Do you do that deliberately too?
Absolutely. I'm the kind of academic who is always interested. What's the answer to the next question? But I know it's a privilege to move on to that next question that we sometimes need to resist if we haven't done enough to actually ensure enough people know about the last answer. Mm-hmm. And I feel like there's a lot of work underway, both in our country and around the world, where the last answer was pretty darn important, and we're not yet acting on it. Whether that's so much of the evidence about how we're putting at risk our children's ability to thrive economically and socially and spiritually on a planet that is rapidly pushing beyond vital signs that, you know, won't put the planet at risk, but will put its ability to sustain human life at risk.
Yes, indeed.
I think that's such a huge existential issue. And then increasingly people aren't seeing that as much these days as we're more worried about our pocketbooks in this, you know, post-pandemic era of inflation and challenges with the trade war. But I can show that the intergenerational extraction from our planet's health is being replicated with the intergenerational extraction from our housing system, leaving too little affordability for those who follow. And also in our government budgets, we extract disproportionately revenue from economic growth to invest in people I love, like my mom and my grandmother, but at the expense of investing too little and leaving large unpaid bills for their kids and grandchildren. And more I'm setting Gen Squeeze up to, like, we do the research. That's why it's a tsunami of evidence, to use your phrase, so that people who want the evidence know that we're not just giving you fake information. Yeah. We are actually robust and grounded in good science. But we spend as much time, if not more time, trying to make meaning of that evidence.
Yes.
And giving you sound bites or graphics that can bring the story told by the evidence home to you so that you can then use it and share it with others.
My guest today is Paul Kershaw, who is a tenured professor at UBC's School of Population and Public Health and the award-winning founder of Generation Squeeze. One of my favorite quotations is from Oscar Wilde, and he said, "A fool is somebody who knows the price of everything but the value of nothing." And it seems to me that what you're doing is trying to inject value into things that are normally assessed in terms of their price. Let's talk a little bit about the five themes, because I did my work, homework.
You did.
The five themes that run through your work, because I think they really are very eloquent in terms of displaying what you're trying to get across to people. So the first is investing fairly in all generations. So what that seems to mean as I look at it is that you go to decision makers and policy makers and people who are in a position of governance, and you say, here's some facts that you may or may not be aware of, but they are accurate and they're detailed, and if they're in language you can understand, and they're backed up by solid, you know, data documentation. What are you going to do about it? So that, for example, you say in the subtext to that particular focus, governments create budgets that set out priorities and assign money to them. And if they send it the right way, then good things happen. If they send it the wrong way, bad things happen. So that's something that obviously plays a big role in what you're doing. That would be, how much of your time would you say is focused on trying to reach out to those kinds of people to get them to listen?
A very significant portion of the time. Mm-hmm. I haven't sat down and ever had like such a detailed daily diary, like what proportion of the time is I'm producing new research today for the peer reviewed literature,
then
what am I doing to like make that meaningful? Mm-hmm. But I take more meetings with decision makers federally and provincially than do most academics. I take pride in mm-hmm. doing that. I think it's a responsibility, at least for someone like me who does public policy research. Mm-hmm. You know, the implications of my research should be shaping the decisions of our elected officials of all party stripes, conservative, liberal, NDP, green. And so early in my career, I would have come kind of more with the hubris of, here's some evidence that, you know, that's coming from my lab and the scholarly community more generally. One, I want to help you be aware of it. Two, it shows there might be a bit of a mismatch between your current priorities and where we ultimately want to go to get the best outcomes for young and old alike. In the early days, that would have made me the hero of the story. I'm coming, giving you the evidence, you have a problem, and I'm going to fix it. What I have quickly come to learn, because I did do quite a lot of studying of political science as part of my PhD, is like, that's a crazy theory of change. Politics isn't going to respond to one professor with some evidence. Politics responds to those who organize and show up. And that made me recognize now in my conversations with political leaders, not only am I sharing the evidence, but I'm also sharing why it is in their political interest to act on the evidence, because we have built a coalition at GenSqueeze alone of tens of thousands of people.
Right.
And we are shaping conversations in the media that's now making it safer for the politicians to disrupt the status quo. And if they are too slow on that, soon it will become dangerous for them not to fix the problem, because it will be viewed as like, oh, you're not leading to correct this issue that needs remedy.
I think that is the policy that has always worked. And a lot of people who deal with government interactions are either working for those government people, trying to make sure that they get back in by telling stories that are not necessarily true. You're coming in from outside and saying, here's a true story. And if you actually do this, it will get you brownie points if you want brownie points. But more importantly, your constituents will love you and they'll probably vote you in next time, as opposed to saying, not interested anymore. Now, the second issue that's part of what you focus on is around healthcare and medical care. You call it medical care, but I think broadly.
Very intentionally. Yep.
Yes. Well, that's interesting, because as a physician myself, I some things have become obvious to me over the years. And one of which is that, and you say this very explicitly, medical care is not the source of health. Medical
exactly.
care is what you do when things have fallen apart because everything else isn't working. And we can talk a little bit more in detail about that. But the graphic I was mentioning that looks like Stonehenge has at the very capstone is health, and underneath it a red cross. And then medical care is sort of in the middle, but it's on the pillars, three pillars: childcare, housing, and income. And so what you've really done is you've embedded what is done in the medical world in a matrix that makes it just one piece, as opposed to the the sentinel piece or the capstone itself. And I think that we'll talk about that some more in a bit, but that's something very valuable because within my own medical community, I don't hear that kind of discussion taking place often, but in my own head and in my own writings, there has been a lot of conversation about that. So that's something to really talk about. The third thing is housing affordability. And that's something that's tied, you tie it into addressing healthcare issues. And so we can link those two together. And then, of course, the other two, supporting young families. And the new one, I would presume, climate leadership and stewardship. When did the climate start to play a role in what Generation Squeeze is doing? When did that become part of it? Because I know in many organizations it's starting to come in, but it hasn't always been there in the origin story.
Yeah, that's a great question. I do think that it was always part of our mission, but it's not what we became famous for initially. Hmm. And so that distinction matters. Generation Squeeze is intentionally framed around a conversation about making the country work for young and old alike, these intergenerational issues. What legacy are we leaving? And we have always recognized in our organization that the biggest existential risk facing young people and future generations is the deterioration of the planet's health. Mm-hmm. The World Health Organization is clear that the greatest risk to human health in the 21st century is Absolutely. Climate change. And so I think that Gen Squeeze has always had this attention to what we thought was the most obvious example of an intergenerational tension. And then we were trying to show, okay, if people understand like we're leaving a mess for our kids environmentally, let me show you how that same pattern is playing out in our housing market and in our government budgets. And so I and we at Gen Squeeze worked harder at trying to have people see those intergenerational tensions in these more wallet-oriented spaces. Mm-hmm. But it then has turned out in recent years, it seems like Canadians have kind of lost a sense of urgency about the risks intergenerationally imposed by planetary ill health. Mm-hmm. And you know, we are in the middle of a conversation right now about strengthening the industrial pollution price in Alberta, and I'm deeply pleased by some positive news there. But that's also going hand in hand with conversations that are, you know, quite content to potentially increase our carbon emissions as a nation. Right. At a time when this isn't a political conversation. It, you know, the climate is biology. The climate is physics. The climate is chemistry. And those reactions do not care about what timelines are convenient for politicians or those of us voting for them. Yeah. And we are desperately running out of time in terms of what we can do to forgo a very frightening set of biological, physical, and chemical reactions that are going to harm our children forever. And it angers me, honestly, like now I don't talk as an academic, I just talk as a citizen. It angers me that we have to be fighting right now, not just about why people generally should be paying for our pollution, whether it's carbon or plastic or otherwise, but why at least even big industry should pay for its pollution. And we have political parties that are saying, no, we want to absolve big industry from that responsibility, thereby betraying our kids by making them pay dearly for pollution that some politicians would let industry dump for free. That is an intergenerational betrayal. It is not how parents and grandparents organize the sacrifices around the family table, and yet we are having to have that fight right now regularly.
So I'm going to give you an opportunity to tell about a thing you did.
Okay.
In 2021, the federal government was being attacked for the Greenhouse Gas Pollution Pricing Act, which said you're going to have to pay if you put a bunch of greenhouse gas in the atmosphere. And they said a minimum boundary. You can't go below this. You can go above it if you want, but you can't go below this. And several provinces, not BC, I'm pleased to say, maybe your mother spoke up or something happened.
She often does.
She does. And you went to court with a group. I'm not sure if it was an ad hoc group, but it was a group of young people saying, this is wrong. You shouldn't do this. This is, you must stick with this federal basement, you know, lining. You can't go any lower than that, and fought back against the provinces who were trying to make this happen. Supreme Court used a phrase. They said, climate change is real. It is caused by greenhouse gas emissions resulting from human activities. The only way to address the threat of climate change is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And your Intergenerational Climate Coalition, that's the group that were part of, spoke out and was, an amicus curiae or whatever it's called. And
an intervener.
Intervener. And things were coming up in the conversation, things like carbon pollution knows no boundaries, which is exactly what you're saying a moment ago. It's a global problem. It's not localized. And it was a 6-3 ruling in support of the federal government. Now, that's the kind of thing that I think you're talking about. It's more than just presenting evidence in a rarefied setting. It's presenting it in a place where everybody goes when they have a problem that they want to be solved at the highest level in terms of rulings and policymaking. What was that like to actually see that happen? I mean, you were there. I presume you were there when that judgment was read out. What did that feel like, to feel like actually darn well getting something done?
Well, here I will hearken back to my mother, since you raised her speaking up in BC. So much of my inspiration is my mom. Mm. My mom has always been a defender of those who have less advantage.
What did you do? Because you mentioned she was.
Yeah, my mom was a lot of her career. She was a school teacher who worked with children with different abilities and extra support needs. When not doing that, she was working with adults with mental handicaps. And now in retirement, she's working to sponsor numerous refugees to come and have a better life here in Canada. And the reason I raise that is, as a young boy, I would see my mom devote extraordinary amounts of time to helping individuals, more than most people, more than I thought I could ever do. And what I noticed after that, as soon as my mom actually did help lift one individual or family to a new level of stability, there was a long line of people waiting for her help, to carry on that work. And it seemed exhausting. And so I share that memory with your listeners because it has driven my career. Mm-hmm. I am not as devoted as my mom to helping an individual needing care on the street, mm-hmm. but I'm sure working, I hope, as hard as my mother, trying to change the systems that result in way too many people needing my mom's care mm-hmm. on the street. Mm-hmm. And so that's what brings us into the world of politics or into the world of the Supreme Court and legislation, because those are the rules that shape our systems. And at the time of the Supreme Court intervention, where Saskatchewan, Ontario, and eventually Alberta were challenging the price on pollution, we thought it was critical to say, yes, we're fighting about a tax policy here, mm-hmm. but we're really fighting about Canada's ambition right now to protect our children and grandchildren from the messes that we are making as adults today. And I want to be able to walk into my nieces and nephews' room, and parents want to be able to walk in their children and say, please clean up your room. But I think we've created a political context that where any young child could say, why should I bother? You know, our political leaders don't expect you to clean up my backyard, my environment, and you're leaving me an even larger mess than my room is right now. And I think that just erodes, you know, parents' abilities to instill the values of, like, you know, if you make a mess, clean it up.
My guest today is Paul Kershaw, who is a tenured professor at UBC's School of Population and Public Health and the award-winning founder of Generation Squeeze. I think you've eloquently described something that you have written a paper about recently, and that is, it's entitled Medical Budgets in an Aging Canada. And it's very explicit about the fact that we discussed a bit earlier that doctors are not the source of health. A system that keeps people in safety, gives them support, gives them a feeling of value and worth in their own lives, is what actually makes people healthy. And I remember a graph that was on the Generation Squeeze website in which the line going up was the consumption of care through emergency and episodic services, and the line going down, in direct contradistinction to the line going up, was one showing the funding of social support systems in the country. To me, that sounded a note that I've been visualizing through the care of individual patients as I walk them through the problems they're trying to deal with, and I see how they can't deal with them sometimes just because the social supports, the kind of community-centered support, is not available to them. Let's talk about that document, because it really quite explicit and quite clear in sort of numerical terms Talk about the numbers of physicians now compared to, say, 25 years ago. There's been a shift that is contrary to what most people believe is happening. Yeah.
It's going to really shock your listeners to learn that we have more doctors today per capita than we did back in the mid-70s when baby boomers were young. So at the highest level, here are the numbers show. The number of doctors today has gone up three times by comparison with 1976. By contrast, Canada's population hasn't even doubled. And so if our population hasn't doubled and doctors have gone up three times, then you can see that, you know, the doctors per capita is much greater today than it used to be. Indeed. And yet we talk about a doctor shortage and people genuinely struggle to access a family physician and many other kinds of care and specialists in a timely way. And so we went into writing this report because we thought we were going to, well, we did. We're going to provide another lens into understanding what's going on. But it didn't work out exactly as I expected once I crunched the numbers. While we have more doctors per capita now, and we may not have had as many doctors to accommodate the fact that when you have an aging population, you're going to need, you know, your population is going to demand more care. So let me slow down and just describe this. It will not surprise your listeners, I think, that as we get older, we tend to need more medical care. It's a biological reality of becoming more frail. When we look at the Canadian Institute for Health Information data, it shows that on average, the typical person over 65 uses as much care as four people under 50 combined. That's not a problem of growing old. That's a reality. But policymakers need to plan for it.
Indeed.
You especially need to plan for it when we know that we call the baby boom a boom for a reason. When baby boomers were young, not even 10% of Canadians were over the age of 65. Now that boomers have retired, 20% of our population is over 65. That doubling of the older population has a massive implication for demand on medical care. It effectively means, in addition to our population doubling in headcount, we've also added 19 million more people equivalent to age 50 and younger. So 19 million more younger middle-aged patients are in the line queuing up for care. We don't see them that way because they're embodied in a larger proportion of 65-year-olds and older. And so I had expected then when we adjusted for the age of the demand for medical care, that increase was going to outpace the rate at which the number of doctors had increased. It certainly closes the gap, but it doesn't swamp it, actually.
No, it doesn't.
The doctors increasing has gone up almost three times. The demand for medical care has gone up by like 1.5 times. And so we right now are having a very interesting political debate in Alberta. The provincial government is saying, well, maybe we'll let doctors work in the private and public systems simultaneously. We've never done that before. And that will help us with our waiting list problems. Or you've got Quebec saying to doctors, we need you to see more patients. I think that the evidence I just tried to summarize for you without a blackboard helps to explain that for people, that we have a greater demand for medical care by boomers, which we're going to have to talk about because we didn't fund it well enough. The boomers didn't contribute enough to that care, and that's going to anger them and upset them to hear that. So that's kind of putting real constraints on our provincial budgets. But at the same time, we have more doctors than ever who are maybe not working as many hours or have incentives to work in ways that don't have them in family practice, and that we need to problematize and consider together more, because if we simply say it's a straightforward doctor shortage, that's not what's happening.
Yes.
And it does lead to, I think, confused debates and a search for solutions that are actually not solutions.
Well, it actually leads to self-supporting, self-centered recommendations within the healthcare community, and especially the doctors community, that we need more family doctors. In other words, beef up the training programs and generate more doctors. And there are some.
And we need to pay them better. Don't forget, in British Columbia, we just added the $130,000 gross increase in the very province where we already had the most family physician per capita.
I know. It's astonishing to me. The other thing that we have done is we've made it a mantra that it is doctors who run the healthcare system. But in actual fact, and thinking of, say, your mother and your grandmother when she was still with us, their care wasn't necessarily that they needed to have somebody, you know, operate on them. They needed somebody to be there when they fell down, or that helped them do things that prevented them from falling down. And there are systems devised in other parts of the world. There's a famous one in Holland called the Boertzorg system, where nurses do most of the care And as a result of the nurses doing most of the care, the doctors aren't needed because the nurses know exactly what needs to be done. They know the patients better than the physicians often do because they see them in their homes. So there's lots of ways to make it so that the system will work better. But at no level is the idea of training more physicians and family physicians in particular the solution. It's a best an interesting concept. But you also came up with some really creative ways to actually generate more revenue for the services that are not being subsidized, things like old age security, ways to cut it off for wealthy people and increase it for non-wealthy people, if I can call them that. Why don't you talk about the ways you had devised in this document, Medical Budgets in an Aging Canada, to make it pay, to make it work?
Yes, if I will answer that question if you'd permit me to take one step back just to amplify a theme that you've already raised. So much of my work is the idea that health doesn't start with medical care. Mm-hmm. Medical care accounts at most for maybe a quarter of what makes us healthy and well. The vast majority is, you know, determined by what I like to call the building blocks for a healthy society.
Yeah, it's up to 85% in many calculations.
Perfect. Okay, so you're even bolder in saying that medical care is a more modest contribution. And what I mean by the building blocks for a healthy society are like, what are the conditions into which you're born, grow, live, work, and age? Do we have strong childcare systems, high-quality education systems, affordable housing? Do we have safe streets? Do we have a stable planet? These are the things that make people healthy and well.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Why do I remind us of that? Because you need to invest in those things. And as you articulated earlier, our research shows that from the mid-70s to today, the proportion of our budgets going to medical care has grown tremendously. The proportion of our budgets going to those building blocks for a healthy society has shrank. So it should be no surprise that the line of people needing care has grown. Not just because the population has aged, but because we actually are not investing in what makes people healthy and well to the same degree.
Your mother's and going to have to go back to work.
My mom, she doesn't get a paycheck any longer, but she is still working her tail off doing this. She's such an inspiration. And so I know we have a need to have good medical care now for our aging baby boomer loved ones. This is my mom. She's 81. I don't think I'm outing her on this issue. And that means we're going to need in the short and medium term to both have these large investments in medical care that are required by our aging loved ones, but also healthy and larger investments in schools, in childcare, in housing, in what makes us well.
Let's talk about the largest undertaxed windfall that many older Canadians have gained, because I think you use that as a pivot for this process.
Yes. I'm infamous, and I do mean that. I'm infamous for talking about the idea that people like me who have gained housing wealth, especially in British Columbia, I have gained more than $1.5 million in my single detached home in Metro Vancouver. And that, for reasons of our capital gains taxation, is not taxed. And I'm not actually proposing capital gains taxation. But I do think that we're all used to property taxes on an annual basis. And I'm somebody who thinks that we should have what is called progressivity in our property tax rates. When we pay our income taxes, people will be used, if you have higher earnings, once your income crosses that threshold, you start to pay a higher level of income tax. So I think it should be with our property taxes, and that those of us who live in homes that are worth more than $1.5 million should, for the value above $1.5 million, contribute more. That is going to disproportionately capture some older people in Canada, and that actually is my intention, because the research shows that the rules of the day on taxes when boomers were still in the workforce did not ask them to contribute enough to the medical care they would ultimately use. That is why every province really these days is running a deficit. I've showed in Ontario that if that province had the same age distribution today as it did when boomers were young, it would be spending $22 billion less on medical care. With nothing else changing in their budget, their deficit would go from a $15 billion deficit to an $8 billion surplus. I can show that same pattern in all the provinces, including in BC.
That's right.
Except in BC, it wouldn't entirely evaporate our deficit. It would eliminate three quarters.
Yeah, that's right. It was pretty close to
three quarters of it would be gone. And so that is a call to action for our baby boomer loved ones to recognize that A failure decades ago by governments to plan for their healthy retirements is now posing massive constraints on provincial governments, whether they're run by a conservative, a liberal, or an NDP. This is not ideological.
That's
it's
right.
A failure to plan decades ago. And now the question is, how do we adapt better late than never? And it's not going to be that we can ask poor retirees to contribute more to their medical
care.
No,
you're very
explicit.
It's wealthy, secure retirees.
We need to go to financially secure retirees mm-hmm. and say, how can you contribute more on behalf of your generation mm-hmm. so that we cover more of your generation's medical care costs in your group and don't leave the unpaid bills to your kids and grandchildren, which result in deficits and less investments in the things that make them well.
You also pointed out a curious dichotomy between cutoff points for funding for different programs. For example, the Canada Child Benefit support system is cut off at $81,000 for your household income, whereas the old age security, which is paid to people who get old, is only cut off at $182,000. I mean, that's $100,000 difference in endpoints, and yet it's not helping anybody. It's actually offering redundant income to people who don't really need it.
Well, I think you've identified this difference in phase out for income support for retirees compared to phasing out income support for families with kids
yes.
as what I think is the most egregious example of ageism against younger people built into our fiscal
that's
policy.
That's what you called it, structural ageism against young people.
Yeah.
Very
I can't.
Turn.
Well, it's a bit wonky, but I use it intentionally because there is an important conversation about ageism in Canada, mm-hmm. and it will focus on those who are elderly, and rightly so.
Yeah.
My mom's at an age where, you know, she is at risk for being kind of discounted because she's older. There are risks when she's in the medical system. There's risk also of elder abuse and taking advantage of her income, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And we should never lose sight of that. But you would be surprised to learn that it is very difficult to get groups that talk about ageism to actually acknowledge there's ageism against younger people. And that this example that you showed is the phase out for the Canada Child Benefit versus the much more generous phase out for old age security is a quintessential example. And so I like to hearken on that.
Mm-hmm.
And one way that actually we could have more financially secure retirees contribute to, more resources to the medical care side of their needs for their generation would be to say, look, if you've got 182 grand of household income as a retired couple right now, do you really need an $18,000 subsidy from taxpayers? I would argue the answer to that is not nearly as much as some families with kids who have a middle income around 80,000 and we're already clawing it back from them. So would you be open to taking less OAS so the savings can be repurposed? And we can repurpose those savings in part to eliminate poverty for seniors. There are 400,000 seniors who are poor. And even though we spend one-fifth of the federal budget on old age security, we leave those 400,000 mm-hmm. seniors poor while delivering 18 grand to those who have six-figure household incomes.
That's
I
right.
don't get it.
Doesn't make
I don't
sense.
Think I don't think many Canadians get that. Our polling shows three-quarters of people don't think that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So let's eliminate seniors' poverty, but let's also do so in a way that frees up funds to invest in the medical care of an aging population, but also the housing, childcare, and post-secondary of their kids and grandchildren. And if I can just add,
sure.
it's easier for me to have a conversation with financially secure retirees to say, could you take less of a cash subsidy? In the Canadian context, I think that doesn't seem so controversial. The health, solving the medical care problem, though, at this moment, and the financing for medical care is more challenging. Because I wouldn't say to that retired couple with six figures of income, take less cancer treatment.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, don't use the range of supports you need in the medical care system.
Right.
We need that universal access to the care in a way that that we don't need as much for cash benefits. Cash benefits can be targeted.
Right.
Access to care needs to be universal. And so we're going to need a revenue conversation to help cover the costs of boomers' medical care.
And the measures you've suggested actually generate quite a lot of income. We're talking about billions of dollars by taking a little cut off taking some of these programs and having the cutoff period earlier. I would also point out that you're also addressing not just intergenerational issues, but intra-generational. You're not actually using
yeah.
the term, but that's actually, as a physician, I have seen a lot of people on one-on-one, as your mom used to do, And you see quite stark differences between somebody who is 75 years old next to another person who's 75 years old in terms of their material security level. And the amount of money would be generated by peeling a little off the top from people who are very secure actually goes a long way. And this has been shown in numerous economic studies. You know, a little bit off the wealthiest goes a long way to help the least wealthy. And it also has, I want you to maybe comment about this. As you probably know, the numbers, 1%, the wealthiest 1% in the world actually produce greenhouse gases for the same as 40, the bottom 40% of the population. And so there's actually a broader social benefit and structural benefit if those at the very top of the material heap end up having a little taken off the top, because it actually makes an enormous difference to huge numbers of people who at the present time are really cut out of the game, as it were, in terms of their ability to survive. What's your thoughts about that intra-generational, addressing those intra-generational issues?
Two quick things, and I see that we're fast running out of time, so maybe this is where we'll be winding up.
Sure.
One, I take real pride in being an organization that is largely viewed to be focusing on, you know, younger people, but I think we're the only group in Canada that has a concrete plan to virtually eliminate seniors' poverty and do it right away.
Sure.
And so that gets to your intra-generational focus, and we are asking, in this case, I use the language slightly different than you, financially secure retirees to take a little less OAS so the savings can be repurposed to help eliminate poverty for poor seniors. I speak precisely that way because there is a broader conversation about taxing wealth and taxing the uber wealthy. The Jeff Bezos, the Elon Musks of the world and their analogs in Canada, although we have fewer analogs at quite that scale, we absolutely have reasons to be asking and inviting them to contribute more, both because, as you've mentioned, they have a massive carbon footprint, which is eroding the planet's health for everybody at an extraordinary rate, and also because of the billions in their portfolio. But when we look at wealth taxes in Canada, when they're proposed, the one I saw the NDP run on most recently in the federal government, it would raise about $20 billion a year. I saw the CCPA, the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives, have a variation on that, which might get maybe closer to $30, $40 billion. I have to go remind myself about its details. But remember, the federal deficit this year, just the federal deficit alone, is over $70 billion. And so these taxes on the uber wealthy are not going to be sufficient to actually balance our budget, let alone raise enough dollars to start investing in some of the things you and I have been talking about are really urgent as the building blocks for a healthy society, which is why I have a conversation, which is a harder truth, that there's actually about 40% of us in Canada who haven't really been all that hurt by inflation, who are actually, I use the Scotiabank phrase, we're a bit richer than we think. No, I am not Jeff Bezos. I'm not anywhere in that ballpark. But as someone who has secure housing, I'm a homeowner, and I have a household income that is, over $200,000. I have quite a lot of security. And I guess when I'm more and more having a conversation with older people who have similar levels of security, we need to recognize you can't take that for granted anymore. Younger folks are struggling so much more than that. Many can't get into home ownership. When they do, they take on mortgages that are frightening. Many are locked into rent indefinitely, and they are paying sums for rent that would make you frightened back in the day if you had to contemplate it. And so I am asking us, those of us who are financially secure at this moment of elbows up, to say, how do we lean in? How can we be a bigger part of the solution? Yes, we need to go and tax the uber wealthy more, but we will have a more healthy conversation that will get us to taxing the uber wealthy more if we recognize those of us who have financial security also could be doing more. And if we can be doing more, then we can darn well expect those who are uber wealthy to do more. And that, I think, is a part of the conversation we need to make politically safe. Because my last observation will be, whether you're talking about the BC election we had a year ago or the federal election we had this past spring, the Conservatives, the Liberals, and the NDP all ran on platforms that said, we will offer you more, we will spend more, and we will tax you less. I don't know how you square that economic circle, and it is part of the cultural problem. Every party thinks they can only win our votes if we say, we'll give you more, but we'll tax you less, as opposed to having a real conversation, a hard truth conversation about how we need to balance our books and pay for what we want. And that's the conversation that I hope that we can have more of going forward, and it's at the heart of what Generation Squeeze does.
I think what you're saying is the same thing as Bill Rees has been saying about yes. our consumption styles. You cannot live on a planet with finite resources and consume four times as much as the planet is able to produce without expecting something terrible to happen that you will regret, and that your young friends in this planet will mutter under their breath for a long time after you're gone, saying, why did they do this to us? Paul, I think you're on the side of the angels. I mean, there, you know, a couple in your own life, but
I do.
But I think what you're saying is something that needs to be heard widely and needs to be, and the fact that you're backing it up with hard data, you know, something that is valued in the academic world, but is really important in the public policy world, and so often is left out. There's so much that's done that's based on looking over your shoulder, saying, if I do that, then I'll be popular. If I do this, I won't. I think the hard truths that you've mentioned frequently in your website, I might add, for listeners, is something really, really valuable for us all to hear. I thank you very much for being with us today. It was a delightful conversation, and I hope we carry it on in some further venues in the future. Thank you.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Take care.